Hello and welcome to a post-election edition of Editing Aloud. And as we sit here this afternoon on Thursday, nobody knows really what's going on, although our panel, I'm sure, will agree with me that roughly what is going to happen has already kind of happened. The ANC, I think we're sitting at about 50, almost 50% of the vote, 45% of the vote being counted, Luke. ANC is sitting on 56.63, which is a sharp fall, as we know. The DA is on 23.4, which would be a remarkable increase for the party that was just speculated that it might fall back a little bit. The EFF far away on 9.32% from doubling its vote, which it might have wanted to do in order to be able to form part of any national government. What do we think of the election, people? I mean, we look like we did before. I mean, it looks like roughly the same kind of country.
Not necessarily.
Go on.
You've got parties like the Congress of the People that will definitely struggle to get one seat back into the National Assembly. You've got the United Democratic Movement of Bantu Olomisa that probably will not get more than two seats in Parliament. And of course, the Inkatha Freedom Party is also is holding roughly what it got the previous time, 2.4% in 2014. Yeah. It's now 2.2. So they roughly have the same people, but you will have three big parties plus the Freedom Front plus joining them. Yeah. So that's the Freedom Front plus EFF, DA, and the ANC with about 90%
but it falls off pretty quickly, Karen Moore, doesn't it? You get the ANC, DA, EFF, 9.32, let's say it gets to 10. At the moment, the Freedom Front Plus is on 2.87, which is a remarkable performance. Anyway, the 191,000 votes. What are we talking about? About 35,000 votes per MP, I think, roughly, is what you need, 35,000, 40,000. But you get down to the IFP and these, you know, and Freedom Front Plus, and they're in, you know, 2.8, 2.14. It's not; these are not big numbers. So we're still left with the three main parties, Karen. I mean, how much does that change our?
I think what's interesting is what's happening on the provincial level,
yeah.
Because I think that we've seen voting patterns that clearly demonstrate that people may be voting ANC nationally as part of a kind of support of the current president, but they provincially are voting for other parties. So if you look at what the IFP is doing in KZN, it at one stage had jumped 10% up from its previous stats in KwaZulu-Natal. Yeah. And there is a likelihood that it may be able to contest with the DA to become the official opposition in KwaZulu-Natal. Yeah. Remember, of course, that the Nkandla municipality is itself run by the IFP, and they've made quite a concerted effort to gain inroads into KZN. Of course, interestingly enough, KZN, one of the kind of hotbed provinces that have been identified as having some of the biggest kind of procedural irregularities so far, and being quite vocal about their concerns about that.
Yeah. The irregularities, Luke, are worrying, but they're not of the scale, surely, that would destabilize this election.
No, definitely not. But I mean, I think we saw the headlines today saying that the DA might challenge. But I mean, it sounds a bit ridiculous if you're like in 2021 and you're challenging. I mean, obviously, if you like say the elections you had in Ghana a few years back, it was 51-49, and the president actually lost and stood down. I mean, that kind of neck and neck situation you can see. You could rerun the whole thing if you're going to move from 21 to 22.
And, you know, whatever the Freedom Front Plus has done to increase its vote, we're not sure, but presumably that it's taking votes away from the DA in some way, but it's not necessarily showing in the DA's performance yet. Mm. It's quite a long way to go.
What we need on that score, Peter, first thing we must acknowledge and remind the viewers out there is that we are still halfway through the mark as we recorded this show.
Sure.
Secondly, the Democratic Alliance has got at this point 1.6 million votes. In 2014, the Democratic Alliance had 4 million votes.
Right.
So if you multiply this by two to get 200%, they may end up with about 3.2 million votes, 800,000.
Which really short. Which is a big blow for them, yeah.
And the Freedom Front Plus obviously took people away. You can talk here about identity politics for the first time. The Democratic Alliance has got a black leader who is slightly confused. The party itself does not know exactly what it wants. Then the Freedom Front goes for it and says, fight back.
Well, it's the same slogan that Tony Leon used in 2004. But isn't it interesting, 1999, isn't it interesting that, I mean, what he did with fight back then was to draw former National Party members into the party, who are presumably now moving off because they've got a black leader or doesn't quite fit what they wanted to.
They certainly have a black leader, and they have a party that is confused about its stance on black economic empowerment and transformation. And remember, if the DA were to just go wholeheartedly and say, we will use race as a proxy and make sure that previously disadvantaged people, it is these elderly, conservative, old white voters, former National Party people that retreated into the DA, that will lose out. Yeah. And they are now trying to find a new champion in Connie Mulder.
Interestingly enough, what was fascinating for me was speaking to one of the members of the Freedom Front Plus, who was very involved in the election campaign, was obviously there's a huge amount, you know, their voter base is seen as being largely Afrikaans, and many of them are farmers. And this issue of expropriation without compensation, the kind of politics of fear that might be playing around that issue and driving votes in a particular direction. Yeah. But his issue, and I think Sukonathi points it out very succinctly, was that they feel that voters go to them more because of the issue of BEE. That their voter base feels that BEE is not working.
Oh, really?
And that they believe everyone should be equal and there should be this meritocratic environment, which is very antithetical to the DA's obviously sometimes very confused messaging. Yeah. And when you have a party where very senior people are openly disagreeing with each other on Twitter about what exactly their BEE policy is, it certainly doesn't bode well for voters to know what exactly their stance is and where they should be going with it.
Add to that Helen Zille's admiration of colonialism and things like that. Then you have a nice cocktail. Together with the parties, the DA has definitely failed to cross and say, we will champion the black cause. We definitely stand for transformation. We stand for service delivery. We stand for clean government. They have failed to do that. And then I've been saying,
and that's because of its own internal arguments.
Its own internal arguments. And I've been saying this on this show for quite a while yet. The way they treated Patricia de Lille in the Western Cape, and before her, the way they treated Mbali Ntuli, the way they treated Lindiwe Mazibuko, does not inspire confidence in the black voters and say that is a party for black people. It is not.
Who was the party president who, for the life of me, I can't even remember his name, also long gone. No, he was an African man.
Which party? The Democratic Alliance?
No, he was chairman of the DA 10 years ago.
You see, that's how how important they want those kinds of leaders. By the way,
interesting. We see Patricia has got 40,000 votes. She's got a seat in Parliament.
You probably are talking about Joe Sirimane. I remember.
I'm talking about Joe Sirimane.
There you go. You have here what the DA has done. It has dumped its traditional white conservative support base, but failed to convince the black people that come here. Yeah. We are your champions.
Yeah. I'm not sure whether it's actually dumped it as such. I mean, you guys spend more time on Twitter than me, but I think I remember seeing somebody saying that about the DA. I think it was something along the lines of nobody knows what they stand for or who is in charge. So, like, you talk about this new black leader. Like, is he really the one in charge?
Who stands for nothing?
On this issue, exactly.
That's who stands for nothing?
But it's similar criticism in some respects that's directed at the ANC because of the kind of factionalism that exists within the ANC. And what's so fascinating is that because of these two main parties, obviously the ANC a lot bigger than the DA, a lack of kind of coherent policy on certain key issues, the ANC's, you know, nationalization, not nationalization views on land, for example, you see kind of radical elements emerging in, like, with the EFF and the BLF. Those kind of organizations are made possible. Correct. And with the DA, you
BLF
see
the BLF has got 5,375 people.
That's
amazing. They're still adamant they're going to get a seat in Parliament.
Who?
BLF.
It's not going to happen for the BLF. It's not going to happen also for the South African Capitalist Party.
The purple cow.
It's not going to happen for Irwin Jim's party either, I don't think, by the looks of it. The PAC, sadly not. We haven't, in a way, become a little slightly more fragmented, but we're not getting the benefits of that kind of fragmentation because they're just not getting over the threshold that they need.
Not at all. I mean, you've got 48 parties on the national ballot, some with as little as 500. I think there's someone with 124 votes. That's their immediate family and 20 neighbors. What needs to happen for this parliament, for every vote to really count, is the Israeli example. There's a cut-off. If you don't make 3%, you don't get a seat in parliament. Those votes get distributed to the smaller parties. Yeah. That's what should happen here, because these small parties have now lost about 10 seats in total, together with spoiled ballots, which is about 2 seats. Mm-hmm. So you've got seats that have votes that have really been wasted and are not going to parliament, are not going anywhere.
Briefly before we take a break, Lukanya, how will the EFF respond to its relatively, I'm not going to say weak, Shane, because it's improved percentage-wise, bigger more than any of the other parties, but it's nowhere near where I think it wanted to be.
Oh, no, definitely. I mean, I think the last surveys they were saying doubling, even more than doubling, up to 14%.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe maybe the rhetoric doesn't really work so much without a proper policy behind it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, maybe, I don't know if that's a lesson they will draw from it, but I mean,
But a lot will still change. Remember, the rural areas are report naturally. Sure. They are late and they
but
will get
not,
their support
that's,
there.
Rural areas are not the only EFF hunting
ground. Not necessarily.
But interestingly enough, they managed to secure a voting district in the deep rural Eastern Cape.
Oh, really?
Which, I mean, I think is very, very interesting because that's traditional ANC hunting ground, and they managed to get it.
Look, the EFF must now organize its elections on Twitter and on Facebook and insist Parliament changes the law. Then they can win.
Yeah. That's very cruel of you. Parliament now has to ratify President Cyril Ramaphosa's decision to fire Norm Nkobo Jiba and Lawrence Mkhwebe, but Jiba is the important character here. Parliament has to ratify that. It's a kind of political test for him, isn't it? Because any sign of rebellion within his own ranks against his decision would show pretty quickly. He's going to have about 25 MPs fewer than he has now or had before the election.
Absolutely. And I mean, remember when Vusi Pikoli, when the decision to remove Vusi Pikoli was made, it was pretty much unanimous. But there's a very different environment at the moment. And I think the Nkobo Jiba situation may well give an indication of just how divided or openly divided the ANC is prepared to be. And, you know, if MPs decide to vote against her being removed, it's possible that decision doesn't get finalized.
It's hard to see the DA putting their hands up for her survival, though, isn't it?
No, I don't see that happening at all. I mean, for instance, someone like Glenys Breytenbach, who is a DA MP, was one of the people who pivotally gave evidence against her in the Mokoro inquiry.
I mean, I suppose a bigger question, is it really possible an ANC that just come into as one office now would challenge its poor president so early into his first term?
Well, it simply has to, the vote has, the ratification has to happen relatively early, I think.
We are expecting a legal challenge from her. Legal people have made that very evident. Yeah. And of course, you know, what complicates the situation is the Constitutional Court still needs to rule on whether it had a basis to allow an appeal by the General Counsel of the Bar against the Supreme Court of Appeals decision while Nkobo Jiba may be incompetent, she was not, and you know, she was not dishonest and unfit. So that story, as the story of the NPA generally, I think is going to still unravel somewhat, and I think akin to what we saw with Tom Moyane, there may be a series of legal challenges that follow.
As far as Parliament is concerned, it's a foregone conclusion that she's gone.
Yeah.
And it doesn't help here that the Jimmy Manyi's party, ATM, only is probably going to go in with just one seat.
One or two, yeah.
Yeah, it's not going to do much.
No.
I thought it won your village.
Yes, it won in the district in which I was born and live, not
oh,
in
no.
my ward.
Yeah.
And that was in a by-election where less than 1,000 people voted. That's the ATM, Lukanyo.
Yeah.
If you combine the ANC and the EFF votes at the moment, they are short of a two-thirds majority to change the constitution.
Yeah, they'll be at 64% as things stand. But remember, again, the rural areas are now reporting. And that's where their support base is coming.
And that'll be a strong point, presumably, for the ANC.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, the CSIR is projecting 57% for the ANC. Yeah. Their statistics are quite reliable, and they've kind of been able to project very successfully. Yeah. So I think that 57% is probably a likely outcome, and they're predicting something like close to 10% for the EFF, in which case it is a two-thirds. Yeah.
So that would be a two-thirds. And in Business Day, we have made this point quite a bit that now the most interesting part will be the wording in the change of the constitution.
Yes.
EFF says we want all land nationalized.
Yeah,
the ANC says we want specific cases. Yeah. We just want the right to do so.
Yeah.
So the compromise will have to be between the two of them.
Yeah.
And, of course, the DA has already said it will go to court to oppose any amendment.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't see the EFF actually compromising on anything. Because for them, it's also about grandstanding. It's about working the ANC and pushing the ANC to a certain point.
Yeah.
So it's not so much about getting any legislation. It's about getting its version of the legislation.
Yeah.
And what's so fascinating is that within Gauteng, which I think is going to be a province to watch in terms of what happens with the vote, the EFF has continuously supported Herman Mashaba for the DA.
Yeah.
I mean, they've taken an absolute stance in support of him.
Yeah.
And, you know, they've said that, you know, even post the election, whatever happens, they still want him as mayor, which is, you know, I find that fascinating because it seems so counterintuitive, but yet that is the firm stance that they've taken.
Yeah. The FM cover, Sikonati, has got a really, really good story this week.
Yes.
Now, you're calling it the Nene Short, and two journalists, Khadija Sharifa and Mark Anderson, from something called the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, have produced this fascinating account of how Regiment's capital, Eric Wood, began to do business with Transnet. This would have been back in 2014, I guess, 2015, and they found themselves in a position where they knew what was going to happen to Nhlanhla Nene, that he was going to be fired in December 2015, and they did a bond transaction in which would net it, because they understood what would happen to the market when Nene was fired, they were able to do a bond transaction which netted them many, many millions of rands and which cost the Transnet pension scheme whatever it was that they made. I mean, they robbed the Transnet pension scheme. Explain to us just how that would have worked. And Lucanio, you both understand, you probably more understand fixed interest securities more than I do, but I mean, what happened?
So basically, Regiments, after Brian Molefe and Arnold Singh became chief executive
and finance
director, Regiments got the contract to manage the Transnet Pension Fund, which is a defined benefit fund, by the way, meaning the taxpayer stands behind.
You get a proportion of your salary.
Yes, you've got a well-defined guaranteed income, even if the fund itself does not make money, the taxpayer will always make good. They managed this fund, and when they knew that Nhlanhla Nene was going to be fired, and of course replaced by Des van Rooyen, they took a bet and said the market will fall.
Yeah.
The value of this bond will really fall.
Yeah.
So we will benefit by shorting
the price of the bond will
the
fall.
The price
right?
of the bond will so we will fall. So they bought the R186 bond, which is the benchmark government bond, a 10-year bond, I think, and said, and Transnet Pension Fund was the counterparty. So they directly traded with their client, and the client didn't know and had no say in the matter.
So the Transnet Pension Fund thought it was getting a good deal by buying all these bonds.
And they were the seller.
Yeah.
They were selling to Transnet. So every rand the Transnet Pension Fund lost which according to our story now is 133 million rands. Yeah. Every rand they lost, Transnet pensioners,
regiments
made in profit.
Yeah.
They shorted the thing. And that's how they didn't go directly, at least using this trade, yeah. They didn't go directly into the currency market, but they used the bond as a proxy. Because if you do go there, then you will have to incur.
Karen, when you read stories like this, this just seems so obviously criminal.
Yes, absolutely. You wonder why,
what is it about? Where is the NPA today? I mean, is she still, Shamila Batoi, is she still struggling for resources? For people who can prosecute this kind of thing successfully, obviously these people would have lots of money to hire expensive lawyers. Where does Batoi stand? Where does the NPA stand now? Is it going to be able to come and take stories like this, take crimes like this, and prosecute them?
Well, when she was interviewed for her position, she made it very clear that it was necessary for the NPA because of like resourcing issues to work with the private sector, to work with law firms, to work with NGOs. I mean, I know, for instance, the Helen Suzman Foundation is assisting the NPA with information about Eskom.
Yeah.
Because, of course, they brought that massive constitutional court case with regards to the contracts. There is a profound deficit of forensic ability within the NPA, and one can see that because we haven't seen very sophisticated corruption or financial prosecutions happening. And this impacts on everything from the so-called state capture matters to Steinhoff. It's across the board. Right. It has quite a devastating impact.
But there's a very deep capacity, Lucanya, in the private sector. I mean, so if we're able to, as a national emergency or in a national effort, to say to the private sector, listen, we need your help. Can you come and help us prosecute them? There's no end of skill and expertise in the private sector.
I mean, you already are doing that, aren't you? I mean, I think that the story you were doing, working on with Trimgrove, and that's one of the Zuma cases where he was complaining that the state had too many senior counsel from the private sector. So, so it already is happening. But interesting thing with this story here, maybe we didn't touch on it, because it says here that these guys, they knew weeks in advance. Yeah. I mean, I was just thinking back when I used to cover economics, I would ask, like in those days of Trevor Manuel, you'd ask him, how long are you going to stay for? Are you going to quit?
Yeah.
And he would say, like, no, I serve at the president's pleasure or whatever. Mm. Then in this case, then, the only one person we have known for sure that, or should have known for sure that Nene is going to go.
Yeah.
So it would be interesting to see who told whom when,
and
when did that person, who would have been the president at the time, because he's got total discretion, or it was a he at the time, discretion to actually decide.
Well, he would have probably just told Dudazani, and it would have been, there was an easy communication channel there with the Gupta conspiracy.
The other way around, Peter, remember, it is them that tell him who to hire.
For sure.
It's not him telling them what he's going to do.
Yeah.
It's the Guptas telling Zuma what to do. So they gave the instruction. In October, Musilo Mutipo at Regiment's capital already knew, because she had been told by Gavin Woods in October 2015 that guy will be fired and will make 9.5 billion rands in fees from Eskom alone.
Yeah.
Musilo Mutipo went on and told Tuli Madonsela, gave that information.
Yeah.
It's part of the state of capture report.
Yeah.
But just to close off, what regiments did here in relation to their client is exactly what the banks did. Remember the subprime crisis?
Yeah.
The reform was no bank shall trade for its own account.
Yeah.
You only trade for clients. Mm. Had regiments had not had that incentive to trade against the client, it would only have only made the fee on the pension.
Yeah.
But it actually set up its own client to fail.
It's quite extraordinary. Talking about extraordinary too, Steinhoff has now apparently made another huge... Is this a new loss or is it just the old loss?
See, this is the old loss. This is a confirmation, I suppose. I suppose you can step one step back.
Very clever, by the way. They put their results out on election night.
On Tuesday night even, on midnight on Tuesday night before the election.
Okay.
Frankfurt wasn't even open then. I suppose Frankfurt was going to be open the next day.
Yeah.
So I think that's the excuse that they had to follow German rules rather than South African rules. Yeah.
So the big thing here, Karen just spoke now about a huge deficit in the NPA of a forensic of forensic skill.
Yes,
that's what's needed here.
Yeah.
Last week, the Hawks already said in Parliament, "Oh well, we are at advanced stages of appointing a forensic accountant investigator to probe Steinhoff."
Yeah.
How many years late? 7 years too late.
I suspect that it will probably be the German authorities because they're investigating, I think, the tax implications of what happened.
No, but I mean, but this guy has to go to jail in this country. I mean, he can't go to jail in Germany. It'd be far too comfortable.
The thing
we need
the German jails are very comfortable. Yeah. I remember I went to Germany and interviewed Jürgen Haagsen, and he had the best time in jail ever.
We need the catharsis. we need Marcus Juster in a South African
prison. Innocent until proven guilty.
Thank you very much for joining us. We'll be back with you at the normal time next week. Bye-bye.